Hey, we are now live on the air. Hey, folks, thanks for tuning into the Banff Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty. And today we're talking about horror. Horror, kids, not the other. And it's going to be in, you know, gaming, RPGs, media. And we have Mr. James Louder from Chaosium here with us. How you doing, James?
Hey there.
Hey, James, you have a long and illustrious resume. I could talk about it for about 5 minutes just looking at your Wikipedia page. Could you give the listeners just a quick summary of who you are and what you're known for?
Well, I've been part of the hobby game publishing industry since the late 80s when I started working for TSR. I was an in-house editor for TSR for several years, line editor in the fiction department, line editor for the Forgotten Realms and Ravenloft and Dark Sun and several of the other smaller lines. Starting in about 92, I went freelance, and since that time, I've worked for most of the publishers in the industry. As a writer, I've done novels for TSR. I did Night of the Black Rose in the Ravenloft line, and Prince of Lies and Ring of Winter for Forgotten Realms. Ring of Winter is being kind of mined right now for a lot of the Tomb of Annihilation stuff that's going on with the big D&D launch this year. I put together anthologies, 20 to 25 anthologies, everything from All Flesh Must Be Eaten to City of Heroes novels. I was the line editor for those for a publishing house in New York. I work as a publishing consultant and was recently hired by Chaosium to relaunch their fiction line. And that's my main gig right now, though I'm still working on other stuff for Shadow the Demon Lord and Pugmire and some other lines in fiction as well. I've also done role-playing games, comics. I was the editor for Hackslash for a number of years, the Devil's Due and Image book, and have written some comics myself.
And didn't you just win any this last time around?
We did. We just won an any for Pulp Cthulhu, a project that was all around for a very long time before it got finished. It actually started in 2003, I believe, was when we started work on that project. And it was supposed to be 1930s Cthulhu, where the characters were powered up enough that they stood a chance of surviving the game. That was sort of, you could win, it'd be a Pyrrhic victory, but you had a chance of winning week to week and surviving. And the project went through four or five different iterations. I was the original project coordinator for it. And it was a D20 product at one point. It went through several versions of Cthulhu rules. And then when the new owners took over, Mike Mason got a hold of the line and said, all right, we're going to finish this and we're going to make it work. And he did a spectacular job pulling everything together. So I was very pleased. Mike deserves the majority of the credit for it, along with Dustin Wright, who was the person at Chaosium back in early 2000s who suggested the game itself, suggested Pulp Cthulhu itself.
So if you wanted to play the JSA or Batman the Shadow going after Cthulhu cultists, this is the game for you.
Yeah, Doc Savage and the Shadow and the Spider the kind of the pulps of that group. The pulps, if you actually go back and read the pulps themselves were pretty apocalyptic. And that's some of the stuff that I actually wrote for Pulp Cthulhu, was framing this in the pulp tradition, where especially if you read The Spider, they're dropping buildings onto groups of nuns and children and melting people and giant plague, Operator 5, there's a plague that wipes out half the United States. And that was kind of the regular week to month for the pulps. These heroes were up against these threats that were going to kill lots and lots of people. So actually it worked pretty well for Cthulhu. If you have that in mind, it transitions really well for Cthulhu again.
Okay. All right. Cool. We should introduce the rest of our roundtable before I forget to. Joining us from the UK is Aid Smith. How you doing, Aid?
Hello. Not too bad, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Joining us from the great state of Oklahoma is Mr. Jacob Blackman.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And we've got Dr. Christopher McLaughlin.
Professor, actually.
Professor, sorry.
That's quite all right. I don't want to get caught lying about my credentials. I'm already in trouble claiming to be Gallifreyan on my application.
So. I was about to say, that's a seventh Doctor
for you. Yeah, yeah.
So, Chris, we should say you're working for Greater Than Games now these days, right?
Yes, and also pursuing some other exciting opportunities that I'm hoping to get more into in the coming year. But yes, my next big thing is for Greater Than.
Okay, we should get those guys on next couple of weeks because they released their quick start for the RPG at Gen Con this last time. So we should try to do that in the next couple of weeks. Also, is Walt Rebilliard joining us from New England. How you doing, Walt?
I'm not scary, but my dog is.
Hey, sorry about that Patriots game, Walt. That sucks. You guys won't be undefeated this year. Hey, how's that German Shepherd doing?
He's looking at me saying, "The Patriots better win next time, or I'm in trouble."
So. How do you feel about that, Chris?
Well, you know, I've always said for years, every time the Patriots lose, an angel gets its wings.
See, I grew up in New England, so I'm with the Patriots here, man. You
know? Right on, James.
Well, you know, if you make fun of a Patriots fan, at worst, they're just going to go cry on their 5 Super Bowl titles. So, you know.
Well, they stunk for so long. If you were a fan of the Patriots back in the 70s, you know, winning now is great, but, you know, you've suffered for it. It's like being a Red Sox fan, you know. There was a long period where they were not good.
But either way, you know, working in the beer industry like I do, either way I win. Because if, you know, I mean, if the Patriots win, everybody gets excited, they get blasted. And sales are good. If the Patriots lose, they get upset, they get blasted. Sales are good. So either way, as long as they're playing, I'm good to go.
That's it.
All right. So horror in that's horror, kids. Horror in gaming and media. Favorite movies or novels? Where'd I get Wade from? Aid, go.
Hi, what? Hey, where's your hi, over?
I was talking about favorite horror movie, TV show, novel, or game. And you can go with Doctor Who if you want.
Oh, well, there's some very, very good horror-influenced Doctor Who episodes. Horror Fang Rock being a particularly good one. But, yeah, I'm actually, at the moment, I'm watching American Horror Story. I've just started it last week, and I'm now in the second series. And it's actually much, much better than I thought it was going to be.
Freaky, though, right?
Yeah, I really did expect it to be like Saw-type horror stuff, where just basically people were just dying left, right, and center with no rhyme or reason. And it actually had a fairly good plot. It was pretty interesting. So,
now the second season, that's the Haunted House one, right?
Second season is The Asylum.
Oh.
Haunted House is the first one. Asylum, the second one. Third one, I think, is the Freak Show. Is it the Freak Show one? The Circus one? Anyway.
Wait, the Asylum one was weird, man. That got dark. Well, I guess it's called American Horror Story. It's going to get dark. But yeah, that just, geesh.
It's interesting. It's got aliens in it. It's got demons in it. It seems to have lots of weird stuff going on with nuns. You know, what more can you want? You know?
To be honest, the second season is my least favorite season of American Horror Story. And I love American Horror Story.
James Cromwell, though, he makes it. He's very good.
I was going to say, as a side note, Jacob, if somebody needs help with that mission that I see in the reflection, let me know. I can log in.
Yeah, we're all very avid Guild Wars 2 players here.
Well, hey, Jacob, while we're talking to you, favorite horror game, novel, TV, movie?
Oh, let's see here. I have quite a few because, you know, I really like the horror genre. Not so much slashers, but very much proper horror stuff. My most recent watched horror film that I really like was The Void. Really, really good horror movie there. It's very much a mythos movie. So to talk about its plot would be to kind of ruin it for you. But I do recommend it for people who love true, genuine horror movies. As a kid, I really liked, you know, the monster movies. So my favorite movie, which I in fact just rewatched last night, was The Monster Squad.
Very cool.
And you know, that had all those classic Hammer film elements to it that I really love. You know, in terms of RPGs, I haven't played that much in the way of horror games. The most long-lasting horror game I played was a World of Darkness Innocence game, where you play children in a horror story. So, you know, very much, you know, getting that Monster Squad feel, it helped there. And in terms of book series, I actually haven't read that many horror novels, so I'm just going to really have to say the classic Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Oh, did you hear his great-great-great nephew is working on an official sequel, whatever that means in this context.
Okay.
Yeah, well, you can't live off grandpa's royalties forever, especially
once the book starts getting ready to go into public domain, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Good point. Yeah.
So, James, how about you? A favorite horror movie, game, novel, etc.?
I tend to like things that are slipstream, right? Things that are sort of cross genre. In terms of like horror novel, I like Cornell Woolrich's Night Has a Thousand Eyes, or Michael Moorcock's Warhound in the World's Pain. Warhound in the World's Pain is ostensibly a fantasy novel. Night Has a Thousand Eyes is ostensibly a hard-boiled detective story. But it's actually a horror novel because the premise is this guy gets, somebody predicts a guy's death, and his daughter and the detective are trying to discover if he's going to die at that time. Is it because fate is real, or is there just a scheme going on? It's like Scooby-Doo, except they pull the mask off and there's something horrible underneath the mask. And there are a lot of works that do that sort of slipstream stuff, especially in prose, are the ones that work the best for me for horror. I still like things like King in Yellow. In more recent things, I just finished reading Victor Laval's Ballad of Black Tom, which is a Cthulhu Mythos novella Tor just published. Absolutely brilliant. Kidge Johnson's Dream Quest of Velibo. Again, it's a modern take on the mythos from a very specific writer's perspective. Here's what, this is how I'm engaging with this material based on who I am as a writer. And it creates a really personal and really inventive kind of take on the mythos.
Okay.
For films and stuff, I'm all over the place. The Unknown, the Lon Chaney Sr. Circus film that Todd Browning directed before Freaks, all the way up to things like Audition or Houzu, the Japanese film House, Videodrome. I like a lot of, and for horror films, I like the films that address the fact that you are watching horror. Things like Videodrome, as I mentioned, Peeping Tom, the British film Peeping Tom, or the great Vincent Price movie Witchfinder General, which is all about characters dealing with violence and watching violence while you're watching a movie in which you're watching violence. So it's inviting you sort of to question your own participation in that. Absolutely cheerful ending too. just lovely. It's like
worth it just for Vincent Price alone. I mean, just to hear him say any words is worth it. So.
Oh, and he is so good in that movie. Yeah. He is just brilliant in that film. Price could certainly chew the scenery and did a number of scenery chewing films like Theater of Blood or the Dr. Fives movies, which I love, and those are really fun to watch. And it's kind of fun to watch Vincent Price bounce off the walls in those. but Witchfinder General, he's really good and really scary.
Well, Chris, how about you?
Wow. Okay. Well, James has these wonderful, concise answers, and my brain, as usual, is all over the place. Because to me, horror is almost something different in every decade that you talk about it. Yeah. You know, looking at the 30s, I don't know if I'll ever love anything more than Bride of Frankenstein. Because the older I get, the more I realize the scary part of that movie is that I think in our hearts we all believe we're the monster and we mean well, but the world will never know that. They will never see us as anything horrible. Or am I just insecure enough to read the movie that way? Don't answer that question. The 1940s, at the moment, I'm currently in love with Curse of the Cat People because, again, it's unconventional horror. Yeah, I mean, the horror in that film is what it's like to be an imaginative little girl in a time and a place where that's completely not appreciated.
Yep.
And it's very hard for me to watch that anymore and not think about all the amazing imaginative ladies that I'm blessed to work with in my life, in my teaching, in the game industry. And I can't help but wonder if I'm watching their childhood or at least bits of it.
Yeah.
And yep. So, yeah. From the silent era, Nosferatu, that's a no sound will keep me up at night. Still terrifies me. Horror in the 1950s. I love Curse of Frankenstein more and more every time that I see that movie, just simply because of the physical portrayal that Sir Christopher gives as the monster. And Peter Cushing, I mean, my gosh, there's probably a film out there, Peter Cushing reading the phone book, and I will get the Blu-ray of that.
Sure.
The 60s, well, somebody stole my Witchfinder General speech there.
Oh, there awesome. The other one I would have mentioned in the 50s and 60s is Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt, which is another one that is kind of ostensibly a murder story. Girl goes home, her favorite uncle comes back to visit, and she finds out the world is a horrible, horrible place.
Yeah.
It's kind of David Lynch before David Lynch.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. It's so funny you mention that because in my little mental file, that's a film noir.
Right.
So, yeah, it's amazing. I never thought of it as a horror film before, but you're right. That's an extraordinary film that just leaps from genre to genre like the best things always seem to do.
Yep.
So marvelous there. Okay, so you spoke up for Witchfinder General. Hey, how about a shout out to Roger Corman's Post Cycle and The Devil Rides Out, the film that that gave me and my wife our names. the 70s. Oh my God. 70s films. My love for Vincent Price Camp comes through. Theater Blood is the first film I ever saw as a child because my parents were just kind of making it up as they go along. God bless them. But there I was, 3 years old, watching Vincent Price kill people and thinking, this is the rest of my life I'm pretty much looking at.
And Shakespeare too. So it was education.
Indeed. I have to admit, I don't much get into 80s horror very much. I Reanimator is probably my favorite film from that decade. And even that's more of a horror comedy. 90s tends to leave me cold as well. But by the time you get to 2000, you get into a really sublime era of horror. And it kind of starts for me with Shadow of the Vampire. And it goes all the way up to Get Out. I mean, if you're willing to do a little work, there are some fabulous original voices in the genre today. I mean, we've been blessed by things like It Follows, It Comes at Night, The Babadook. I mean, really, seriously, I don't know if there's a better, except maybe the 70s. I don't know if there's been a better time to be alive and be a horror fan.
There were a lot of interesting things that were being done in horror in the 80s in Europe, where you ended up with things like The Beyond, and the first two of the Suspiria and Inferno, the first of the Three Mothers trilogy.
Yes.
And both of those are absolutely brilliant. Inferno, especially, for me, really, really works.
I have to admit, I'm not the world's biggest Argento fan, but I've always loved how his films, to a great degree, especially when he's in the zone, it's like watching a nightmare.
Yes. Yes, and that's exactly what the European tradition for those movies does right. There's a scene in Suspiria where a girl is running away from the killer, and she crawls through a transom into a room that's filled with razor wire. Why is the room filled with razor wire? Doesn't matter. Welcome to my nightmare.
I've seen that one scene of the movie and nothing else.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that this will and that stuff sticks with you. There's a scene in Inferno where it's about this building that's got this weird history to it. And a woman is down investigating the basement and drops her keys into what immediately looks like a puddle. And then she ends up having to swim down into an entire flooded room below the house where there are corpses floating around trying to get her keys so she can get out. And so you get that with a lot of the Japanese films too, you know, Getsu or Kwaidan, the Hochi, the earless sequence in Kwaidan. If you've never seen that, is based on different traditions in horror. So watching them as somebody who isn't necessarily steeped in that tradition makes them more alien and dreamlike, and is a real invitation then to go back and read the source material. I've read a bunch of Japanese fairy tale material and classical story material because of films like Kwaidan.
No one mentioned these zombie movies. No one mentioned Blair Witch.
I tend to be a bit of a purist. To me, Night of the Living Dead and is science fiction because it's all caused by the radioactive satellite. But if you want to count that as a horror film, it's surely one of the best ever made.
Yeah, Dawn of the Dead as well, the original Dawn of the Dead. Though the remake is okay too.
Until you get to that post credit sequence, and that's where I first wanted to strangle Zack Snyder with my bare hands.
Sure. Yep.
Okay. Patricia Tallman one, the 90s one.
Yes.
Got to talk about, yeah.
The
Night of Living Dead remake is which the thing that was so clever about that was changing the narrative about race in the first movie into a narrative about sexism and misogyny, which works. And that's the best part about zombie films is zombies are kind of a blank slate. You can lay any message over the top of those stories you want. And if you're going to tell an intelligent story that will draw people in and be worth watching over many years, like Dawn of the Dead, it's about consumerism. The whole thing being set in the mall and why do they come here? They knew it was important to them in life. That's a level to that film that works because the zombie is a blank slate.
I like Day of the Dead out of the earlier ones.
Yep.
That's my favorite.
You know, not to ruin it for you, but just to make mention of this, if you ever get an opportunity, somebody has posted George Romero's original script for Day of the Dead back when he had 10 times the funding.
Yeah.
And I set out to glance at it, wound up reading the entire thing in one sitting, and I had a little tear in the eye at the end. it's honestly the greatest zombie film that will never get made. Sure. If you appreciate Day of the Dead, looking at what might have been, I think I would recommend.
Hey, Walt, how about you?
I started young on reading horror, especially in novels. Somebody turned me on to H.P. Lovecraft. A lot of people on the podcast know that English is actually my second language. So somebody recommended H.P. Lovecraft as a way to engross myself in some of the fringes of English. So
simulations and non-Euclidean geometry,
right?
the easy stuff. Yeah.
I mean, I had a
good promise on that smelling test. That right?
I had a good grasp of things, in the main portions of the language. But you know, I really wanted to live up to my grandfather's expectation that if you wanted to be treated well in life, you had to speak well. So that was one of the things, and. H.P. Lovecraft really touched my love of both sci-fi and horror. But later, as I got older, one of the things I love is any type of horror fiction that truly displays how the human animal behaves under stress. So favorite book, horror book of all time has to be Needful Things, just because of the fact that Stephen King writes a great person story.
Yep.
And investigating how people react over things they need versus things they want, and stuff like that. And any situation where the protagonist has to be reduced to base impulses, and you see what that person is really like versus what they portray in normal society. So things like Dean Koontz's intensity, what was the one with the writer that gets run off the road and
Misery.
You know, I mean, yes,
the film that will have you waking up middle of the night screaming because you've had a nightmare that somebody, I don't like what you did with that guy's stat block.
Very true. Very, very true.
Right.
If you like those kind of books and you haven't seen it before, there's a Jonathan Carroll novel, one of my favorites, called The Land of Laughs.
Oh, yeah. I've actually read that.
Yeah. It's about a writer who ends up in a town that kind of is like the one he created. The John Carpenter movie Mouth of Madness is sort of the same story with the serial numbers filed off. The Carroll novel is brilliant. But yeah, Land of Laughs, if you get a chance to dig that up, I think based on the books you mentioned, you dig that one.
I'm writing it down right now. But, yeah, you know, to go according to what we have in the background on the screen with James, first horror game, Call of Cthulhu. Absolutely loved it. You know, I love the fact that we went from Dungeons and Dragons and Marvel superheroes back at that time, and then all of a sudden we no longer had powers, no longer had fantastic magic to call on. Well, unless you were absolutely crazy.
Right.
And you had to figure stuff out and get away from the horror, you know. And I think games like that and genres like this show that, you know, we can reduce everybody to basically one line. And it's that meme from a zombie movie where I don't have to be the fastest. I just have to be faster than you, you know. So, I mean, yeah, there's great genre. There's a lot of good stuff out there.
Yeah.
So we used to alternate between second edition or first edition, probably the AD&D, and Call of Cthulhu. And Cthulhu has always been the game that I love the most but never get to play. Because I can never find a group at the moment that actually wants to play it. So it's really difficult to actually do it. Because, oh, we're all going to die at the end. What's the point? So that is the point. It's the story. You tell
it's
the story.
It's how you get there. It's whether you have a good death or not.
They can't get around that. A lot of them seem to just want to devil and make sure they get their characters to improve. And, hey, like 120 hit points rather than 115.
Right. Yep.
It's like, no, we want to see, tell the story. Tell the story and you'll really enjoy it. But, yeah, the early stuff for, like, oh, God. Is it Stars of Right, Spawn of Azathoth, and all those campaigns? Love those. Absolutely fantastic stuff with those. Brilliant.
Well, that's
so, yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
With horror gaming, I mean, you just hit on one of the main things, is it's not the same type of experience that you get with D&D, where you're building up and the point of it is to have this character that will go week to week, and you're building a story over a long period of time. With a horror game, really, you're talking about much shorter narratives and stories that can be told in one night or two nights as you're playing, which makes it a very different gaming experience. And Cthulhu, as a game, does that the best because it is baked right into the system. The more you know, the worse you will be.
Mm.
The more that you discover, the more you're going to pay for it, and the closer you are to dying or going insane and then dying. And that's, I think, the strongest part about it. But it does take people, it does take players who are interested in playing that kind of game.
And, you know, years later, after playing that game, I had already gone my 20s and I was into my 30s. And they came out with that movie Event Horizon. And I was like, oh, my God, it's Cthulhu in space. Let's do this.
Right.
You know, so good. Definitely good stuff. It's something that can cross genre, cross time periods, as you know, many publishers have displayed. I think it's a great setting.
The interesting thing about it as well is nowadays we're getting a lot more of those storyteller games like Fate and all this kind of stuff where there isn't a lot of character development, but there's not leveling, and Cthulhu fits right in with that.
Yep.
So I think Cthulhu should be. That's what I'm trying to sell to the people I play with. It's like, yeah, it's like it's a story game. It's not a leveling game. Don't worry about the leveling, worry about telling the story. So hopefully, yeah, we'll get you to persuade them. But yeah, I think it fits in right there.
This is a good point to mention. I'm going to tag on to the back end of this podcast. Walt and I interviewed Orion Canning last week. He recently wrote a story game called Abnormal Things, which is, you know, it's a storytelling game designed to tell stories similar to the Stranger Things, that show by the Duffer Brothers on Netflix.
There you go.
And based on Abnormal by Avery Adler. So something to check out. Hang out, run out for this podcast for the interview with Orion. It's definitely worth your time. James, you might be the best person I can think of to ask this question. Do you have any good GM tips for running an effective horror session?
I think it's sort of the same things you'd use for storytelling for a horror film, maybe less with a novel. you need to be careful about your control of information, what you're telling the players as they move through things. They will always imagine worse things that you than what you will come up with to do them in. So if you throw out information and pace the game in a way that allows the players to imagine the worst and gives them time to imagine the worst, they will participate in the horror storytelling with you. And that means sometimes throwing out things, noises that don't necessarily mean anything. And sometimes you throw out noises that means the thing is right behind them. And if you as the GM, you vary those, you keep the players sort of out of their comfort zone. They don't know when the next thing is going to happen. And that's an important part. The rest of it, though, is you know, just that idea that you need to control information and be careful about how you pace things out and give them the opportunity to win some fights, but know that all fights are going to have a cost. Those things are the ones that I think, just as a GM, I use in putting together horror games.
Okay, Chris, how about you?
Well, I have to give a tremendous vote of respect to an old friend of mine, the Reverend Todd Kingria, who was our resident Call of Cthulhu GM. And everything I know about running horror games, and really a good chunk of what I know about game mastering, I know from just watching him work. And James talking about the importance of the imagination reminds me a lot of the miracles that he was able to work in his kitchen out in Radford, Virginia, because while he had definite plots in mind, he was always very, 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 very careful about getting information out of there, letting people imagine their own horrors, as James said. But I always loved how he did a great job of setting the atmosphere. I mean, his players immediately forgot that they were just sitting in his kitchen, you know, and like, you know, the scariest thing near them was, you know, maybe the microwave might land on them. And he always had this oil lamp for his games. He always ran his games in like as near total darkness as you could get away with and still see your dice. And it's just amazing how much creepier everything is when it's near dark. And honestly, I especially I think the more we get into this modern 24-hour age of ours, I think we become all the more terrible of an absence of light. And honestly, I don't think I ever really got comfortable in the dark till I started Civil War reenacting and I had no choice but to hang out by the campfire. And even then I had a gun with me. So yeah, you know, I mean, it's a game where I think atmosphere really, really, really does pay off.
Yeah. And when you're doing individual scenes, going through and making sure you've got written out a description that conveys the information you want.
Yes.
Is very important when you're doing it. It's really hard to do that off the cuff. So actually do the paragraph description of what the room looks like or what the creepy old house looks like or what, you know, the headless body you just found looks like. And that goes under the control of information too, but it's also, as Chris just said, setting the atmosphere, setting the scene.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, if sometimes, you know, if you're an artist, you get lucky and you tap into something that scares the whole world, like George Romero and zombies.
Right.
But for most of us, we're not that brilliant and or lucky. And, you know, I mean, the only way you can truly get horror across to your audience is to let their own imaginations go to work on them.
Yep.
Anybody else have experience running horror games? It sounded like you did some Call of Cthulhu back in the day. Well,
yeah, you know, well, back in the day that we're talking many, many moons ago, you know, kids, you're only exposed to so much. And it, what I've noticed about running horror games, we just finished up a game of Savage Worlds Rippers. The one thing you notice is that the aspect of the horror in the game becomes increasingly more subtle and touches on your, like you guys were saying, touches on your player's fears more than what you fear. Because in the beginning, when you're running these kind of games, when you're young, you know, you really don't know a lot about other people's fears or the fears of people at your table, other than, you know, your buddy once mentioned, "Oh, I hate clowns." You know, so I mean, so
that's, you know, not really helpful, you know, if you think about it.
So I mean, you really base things off of your fear when you're running your games when you're younger. But then, as you understand more about human nature and you understand more about people, as you get older, those games become more complex and the horrors become subtle, because instead of touching on your fears, you're now trying to tap into and activate those fears of your players at the table. So, now that we're in such a modern age where, you know, these James Bond devices that we have floating around everywhere, you can do some really creepy tricks. Like, they were investigating a series of murders in our game recently, and you know, I texted to somebody in the other room. I'm like, do me a favor, when you see the text message that says go, pick up a phone book, drop it flat on the floor. You know, and this murderer had been going around, and later on they found it had a supernatural aspect, but they found out it was this person had been going around and shooting people, you know, from rooftops like a sniper. And you know, they're sitting there and they know they got him trapped in this one room because they knew it. They had him pinned, and all their powers in there and their notice checks had led them to that point. And all of a sudden the phone book drops, everybody like lunges from the table because, you know, they're going after this guy. And the sound of that phone book just put everybody into overdrive. And then they look, and you know, I describe that the NPC that had been leading them through that part of the city as their kind of guide, just turns, and you know, he's like mouthing, like he's trying to breathe, and he pulls down his little ascot, and he's got a large caliber hole in his neck. You know, so now they're all diving and dice are rolling, and it really, you know, the fact that I had a cell phone that I could text message somebody and be like, at dramatically appropriate time, please drop phone book, thank you. Right. You know, that stuff is amazing for stuff like that. Or even during a convention, I had planted these mini walkie-talkies around the room. You know, and like random noises were coming out of places in the room, and it's just, you know, a lot of fun stuff can be had if you look at some everyday common things and just play around with them. You can create atmosphere.
That's good GMing, period. It doesn't matter, you know, that it works especially well for horror, but yeah, I mean, you're crossing the line for some of that stuff into LARPing, essentially.
Yeah.
With that, which is great.
It was definitely fun. You know, yeah, even with the walkie-talkies, they were looking for a security guard at one point, and they keep saying, hey, you know, please respond. And then at one point, you know, I turned the walkie-talkie on my side, and they heard it all the way in the other room, and they're like, whoa, what the hell is that? Because it was just us in the house. So now they go up to, you know, one of the guys goes up to investigate, comes back with the walkie-talkie, and, you know, I hand him a note that says, you know, you found the dead body, and here's the description. So, I mean, stuff like that can be a lot of fun, you know, just play with your environment a little.
You know, with my luck, if I tried that, I'd start getting stuff from the local Air Force base, like Spider-Man.
Massachusetts, you'd call in the bog sprayer, and, you know, then your house is just covered in mosquito fog and
oh.
How about it, Mike? What have you done? Any horror gaming?
I can't say that I have, actually. I ran a lot of Werewolf back in the 90s, but I hesitate to call what I was running a horror game or a personal horror game, however White Wolf wanted to bill itself, because it all kind of wound up being, you know, the regular Werewolf modern day stuff sort of wound up being, you know, furry X-Files. But I won't say furry, like furry. I want to say like hairy people doing X-Files, or, you know, hairy people as vigilantes and superheroes. I did a Wild West campaign for a long time, which kind of wound up being, you know, if you were mashing up werewolves and Clint Eastwood in this, you know, 60s or 70s.
Well, you know, Mike has brought up an interesting point, I think, for those of us that work in the tabletop industry, is isn't it funny how Vampire and all of its offshoots kind of flipped the table as far as, like, even a horror themed game was. Because I remember when somebody first showed me tried to turn me on to Vampire, my rather glib response was, hey, everything I need to know about vampires I learned from Carl Kolchak. Right. You know, I could never quite wrap my head around, oh wait, now we're the monsters. But
that changes the dynamic. It changes the dynamic. Though you can still do really good World of Darkness stuff where you're introducing the characters into the world where they don't know what's going on. Josh Deutsch did a brilliant, brilliant World of Darkness novel toward the end of White Wolf, right before they were bought out by CCP, called Strangeness in the Proportion. It's available, I think, still as a POD and as an ebook. Fantastic thing about a guy who just thinks he's kind of an odd guy. He works in a mortuary and medical examiner, and he likes silent films, and he's kind of a fan of that kind of comedy and pratfalls and stage magic. And he realizes over the course of this book that the world is the World of Darkness, the entire, you know, span of the White Wolf milieu. And it's a fantastic horror novel. Fantastic horror novel.
Yeah, I just thought, because I've never found a way to do it quite right, and I always gravitate towards other genres, but I gotta say, I don't think I was alone, because honestly, most World of Darkness games I knew of sort of wound up being supernatural superheroes at some point.
Sure.
So. That is an issue I personally had with the World of Darkness, is the characters really didn't feel like monsters. As my roommates are often fond of saying, it's more like you are superheroes with a daylight allergy. I have never played it myself, but they have fond memories of playing a game called Chill.
Oh, sure.
And there was a source book for that called The Creature Feature.
Yep.
Allowed you to play monsters. And in that, you played monsters. You weren't this, oh, woe is me, vampire. You were a, I am the night, I am darkness, I am evil vampire.
Yeah.
And you could do things like, you know, find a person who you wanted to kill and just slaughter them. And, you know, that'd be fine. But if you did creepy things like ate their family one at a time, you know, nailed their favorite pet onto their door, onto their doorstop, and stalked them for a couple of weeks before you finally killed them, then you got all this power that came to you because you were being a monster.
Jesus Christ. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's something that the new White Wolf is facing right now with, you know, with the idea that how much fun is that to play?
I mean, yeah.
You know, where is the line on this is a game and it is, you know, there's a moral component to it. There's a social component to it, and playing the monster and being the monster comes with a whole different set of values.
Well, there's something about a game that you pick it up and you kind of feel like you've picked up your copy of Violence by mistake.
Yes. Yes. Right. But the challenge then, if you play World of Darkness where the characters are tragic and they're misunderstood, then, you know, are they just superhero characters? Because at heart, they're positive. World of Darkness, I always found Mage to be the most interesting part of the setting, because those were characters that were trying to make sense of the world, the larger part of the world. Mm. And they could be gray, but it was never the same sort of the same sort of black and white that you got with the rest of the game.
So yeah. Sorry, go on.
No, please go ahead, Nick.
I was gonna say I played Vampire for years. I played Werewolf for years. I played Mage for a fairly short amount of time, and then onto Changeling for a little bit as well. So I'm a really big World of Darkness fan. But you are right in saying that the Werewolf stuff did turn out to be more of a power gaming thing rather than a horror thing. I love the monsters in Werewolf, the Werewolf monsters, and the idea of Pentex being this hidden horror that is always there is fantastic, and I love the setting for that. But I think the best game we ever did in World of Darkness was them effectively playing a Scooby-Doo like group of wiggly humans that were investigating this weird stuff going on, because it was now a World of Darkness Call of Cthulhu game.
Right.
And it was much more interesting there, because you were actually scared of stuff. When you saw a werewolf, you ran away from the werewolf. You didn't go and smash it down with whatever you've got going on. So, love the setting.
Yeah, and that's the like I mentioned, that Joshua Deutsch novel. That's really what it is. And it's this character who has these sort of weird powers, and he's a weird character, and he's trying to find out what his place is in the World of Darkness. And which side does he belong in? Does he belong in the shadow? Does he belong in the light? You know, the working assumption all of the normal characters have at the beginning of a story is that, well, we're the good guys. Of course we're the good guys. Because we're us. And you can do some really interesting gaming where the characters discover that they're not the heroes, or that the world is much more complicated than it seems. And that is one of the core elements of horror, just as horror. Is you have characters who have assumptions about the world, and by the end of the story, they realize the world is not what they thought it was.
Hey, I just wanted to make sure. We brought up Pulp Cthulhu, right? The book you won the Emmy for?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Any supplements coming out in support of that? Adventures or?
There's an adventure book out, Two-Headed Serpent. There's probably going to be more things for it. The company's been very happy with the response to it. It's a fantastic book, and you know, one of the things I mentioned early on was that, you know, that book started in 2000 and whatever, and went over all of these different incarnations. And the thing that I really marvel at Mike Mason being able to do is go back and pull a lot of the material from the earlier incarnations of the game, the book. And found ways to include them seamlessly into the new material. Mm. So Wolfgang Bauer had written an adventure for the very first version of it, set in Shanghai, and that in a version of that made it in. Jeff Tidball had done some stuff on the setting in the 1930s that made it into the final. The material I did on the pulps made it into the final. Mike Mason, and that's all in the service of a really great rule system that tweaks the Call of Cthulhu basic rules just enough that it is heroic, but it's not so overpowered that it's a superheroes game. It's a great design. They did a fine job with it. Mike did a fantastic job with the rules.
Yeah, when you mentioned you could win from week to week, I was like, wow, that makes it a wildly optimistic version of Call of Cthulhu.
You get right, but that's, I mean, the idea is that. This was the thing from the original pulps, that Operator 5, you know, was fighting the war against the Purple Empire month to month, and he would win at the end of the given month, but nobody was ignoring the fact that, oh, the Purple Empire did gas half the United States and killed everything. That's still, you know, there's the ruin behind you, but you've managed to save the other half of the United States for this month. Congratulations. and that's where it's actually, I think, the idea of doing a pulp style Cthulhu game is actually fitting for the pulp. If you actually go back and read the originals, it's fitting for the pulp era.
Another good thing for pulp would be Lobster Johnson books. That would be perfect. I can see that work really well. Yeah.
Yep. The Mike Mignola stuff definitely taps back into that the whole Hellboy. Setting, that whole era material they do too taps into that tradition.
Yeah, maybe. I guess Magnolia would be a good sense for a lot of stuff related to Call of Cthulhu, because those kind of themes come up over and over. Can we ever have too much Cthulhu in pop culture and gaming especially?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, it is absolutely entirely possible to have too much Cthulhu.
Have we reached that point? Are we at Cthulhu saturation?
Well, there's Cthulhu Yahtzee, and it's shaped like Cthulhu. It's kind of crazy when you think about, I mean, for me, I was introduced to the Lovecraft material through the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game in the late 70s. One of my, the family, three brothers I role-played with, we played D&D, we played Villains and Vigilantes, and we were going to try Call of Cthulhu. The older of the brother had all the Arkham editions, and so he knew the Lovecraft material. But beyond getting it in that and some of like the Ballantine Adult Fantasy stuff, nobody else was doing anything with that material. There were occasionally bad horror adaptations like the Dunwich Horror and movies like that. Occasionally, you know, the episode of Night Gallery that did Cool Air with the horrible, horrible flamenco guitar through the whole thing.
I still think that's an incredible adaptation.
It is a great adaptation. The music kills you, though.
I never notice it. I get so wrapped up in Barbara Rush's performance.
Yes, it's a great adaptation. But how obscure that material was. Now it's everywhere. Now everybody sort of understands. You know, there's a Library of America edition of Lovecraft stories. It's made it into the mainstream.
So has anyone else read Alan Moore's Providence?
Yes.
See, this is exactly what it's about. Alan Moore's Providence effectively is Cthulhu who really exists, and there's a competition between his reality and our reality, and he's slowly been sneaking in Cthulhu references to take over our reality and bring his back.
Right.
So you see Cthulhu toys and Cthulhu games and Cthulhu, because Cthulhu's really out there, and he wants people to worship Cthulhu so that Cthulhu takes over.
Right.
And it's brilliant. Love it. Yep. Providence is one of my favorite books last year. Absolutely spectacular.
Oh, it's a great comic. And you know, that's one of the things in the argument for public domain, where things go into the public domain, because you really want creators to be able to comment on the things in the popular culture around them. So, you know, I'd mentioned the Victor Laval book and Ballad of Black Tom and Kidge Johnson's Dreamcast of Velvet Bow. That's what those are. Those are those creators doing brilliant responses to that material, which they wouldn't be able to do if that material were not in the public domain.
Hmm. There might be someone suing to get But the Bright for rights for Buck Rogers, and so.
Oh, good God! Don't bring up Buck Rogers. I work for TSR, man.
You know all about that.
I still love that game. I love that game.
The Buck Rogers game from TSR was pretty fun.
The role playing game was amazing. My first Gen Con was demoing the Buck Rogers board game at the castle back when TSR had the castle. Actually, the first bit of published fiction I did for TSR, and not a lot of people know this, is I ghosted one of the stories in the Arrival anthology. I wrote it over a weekend, and then the editor rewrote what I had written because a bunch of the authors had bailed out because they could not bear working on the material anymore.
Oh, God.
And so I got to write a story over the weekend, and it's under the name Ulrike O'Reilly, because that's not a fake name.
I eBayed all of the original Buck Rogers stuff and the novels, and I'm getting the Mega Drive retro console, and the first thing I'm buying for it is the Buck Rogers game. Play it again.
Yep. There's a lot of that material, and I think Jeff Grubb and Mike Pondsmith, the material that they created for it is fantastic. The gaming stuff, the role-playing stuff that they created for it, it is great. And it's too bad that it didn't get the attention it should have gotten because people were reacting to it being Buck. And the board game, the Buck Rogers board game, the big honking Conquer the Universe game, was really fun, actually. It's a good board game.
Yeah, just when you, if you're not looking at the gaming products or the comics, I think Dynamite had a few years ago. It's, you think Buck Rogers and you think, well, the 1930s or, you know, the Gil Gerard series from the 80s, and
yeah, like, you think Tweaky.
Oh, totally, yeah.
And so you wonder, well, why is someone, I mean, because lawsuits aren't cheap. They're spending a lot of money to contest, you know, who has the rights to this stuff. So.
Right, and it's the heirs of Philip Nolan, who had written the original Buck Rogers prose fiction in Amazing Stories, and the heirs to the Dilley family, John Dilley was the newspaper syndicate guy who put together idea of Buck Rogers from that thing in Amazing Stories with a comic strip artist, and then popularized the comic strip. Mm. But he didn't create Buck Rogers. The Dilley family tends to lean heavily towards saying that John Dilley created Buck Rogers. I don't think that's entirely true. It all depends on how you want to define create, I guess. But that's what the fight is it's between the people who are the heirs of the guy who wrote the Amazing Stories novella, and then the newspaper syndicate's heirs.
So it's like, again, we're in a similar Alan Moore territory. It's like, hey, you didn't create Watchmen. You just adapted some DC stuff to be the Watchmen.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, wow. Okay. That was a long, interesting tangent there, yes. James.
I'm sorry. You mentioned Buck Rogers. I get these flat. it's ugly.
He used to work at TSR. I should probably know better than to bring that up. Probably a sore spot. But, all right, well, hey, I think we should go ahead and wrap things up. We're coming up on the hour mark. Anybody have any last-minute thoughts, things they want to get out there?
Yeah, I wanted to thank everybody that has picked up our Hurricane Harvey charity fundraiser bundle that Mike put together. And by the way, God bless you, Mike, for putting that together. And, Aide, thank you in particular for making my words look good in, like, 3 hours, I think, they gave you to do that.
It took me a couple of days. It took me I did it about 8 hours, I think, all time. So,
well,
as long as you were happy with it, that's all that mattered. Because I was getting a bit panicky.
really, I felt like such a jerk. Hey, Mike, I know it's the last minute, and I've just been grateful for everything that's happened from there, and I'm really proud to be even a tiny part of what you guys are doing, and really just taking that negative and turning it into a huge positive. I really, really thank you guys. And thank you guys for everybody that's bought that.
We should probably mention to our listeners that they can still get the Hurricane Harvey charity bundle on RPG Now or DriveThruRPG. It's a $25 donation for over $400 of gaming PDFs. A ton of stuff. Lots of OSR, Mutants and Masterminds, Fate, Savage War, all kinds of stuff on there, all kinds of genres. It's for a great cause because I don't know if you've watched the news lately. Things are a little messed up in Texas right now, and there's a way you can help out and get some great gaming products at the same time. It's running through midday on Tuesday, and Tuesday in this case being the 12th of September 2017. So please check it out while you can. The generosity of the community has been really great to see. We're over, remember the last update I gave you? Was it 17?
17 and change, yeah.
Yeah, so that's great. Yeah, that's not even a full week. So, yeah, please give that a look. We'd appreciate it. The BAMF podcast has a Patreon, you know, like PBS. Feel free to check us out and, you know, drop us a buck or two. And we'll wish we could send you a coffee mug, but we can't.
Tote bag.
Someday we'll get tote bags. We should get shot glasses or I don't know, something.
No, just make sure if you're going to monogram anything, thong underwear.
What's wrong with you, Walt? What's wrong with you?
Hey,
he's got the right priorities.
I'm keeping with the horror theme.
Yeah, there you are.
And it all ties back together to horror. Horror, kids. Horror. There's two syllables there. So thanks, everybody, for coming out today. It's been great talking with you all. And listeners, we'll catch you next time on the BAMF podcast.
2 1/16, 1. Go.
Yellow live.
Yep.
Hey, folks, thanks for tuning into the BAMF podcast. I am your host, Mike Lafferty, and we're here today to talk about horror and a few specific things, Stranger Things, Stephen King, and we've got O'Brien here to talk with us about his game, Abnormal Things, which is Ryan Canning, sorry, which is inspired by Stranger Things. How you guys doing? Also, Walter Billiard is a co-host today. So how you doing, Walt?
I am an afterthought. I love myself. Go for it.
Ryan, how are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for coming. We had some scheduling problems because of Gen Con and everything, but it's great to have you. Well, hey, let's talk about Stranger Things, which is kind of the inspiration for your game. It kind of tapped into a big sort of retro horror vibe. I think it was maybe surprising to a lot of people that there were that many fans of that thing. What appealed to you about?
It's very 80s. It's very, touching on all those movies from that time period, right?
Mm-hmm. Would you say that's your primary inspiration for Abnormal Things, or kind of that's that whole genre? 80s horror, small town kind of?
I mean, I am a big fan of 80s horror. And it was definitely the inspiration. I really love the show. I don't usually binge watch shows. Like, I'll watch like a couple episodes a day, but I stayed up all night watching that show. I really loved it, and I knew I was gonna love it. I was kind of like putting off watching it because I knew I was gonna love it, and get throw off my sleep schedule probably, which is what happened. Yeah, I really liked it, and I played some other, there's been a few games coming out, actually, other people wanting to do that, tell that sort of story in a game, and I was just looking for that, but the games I had played didn't really do it for me, so I wrote Abnormal Things.
Oh, all right, cool. Have you seen the trailer for the sequel to Stranger Things?
Whoa, the trailer?
Yeah. I haven't watched it because I avoid that. I don't like spoilers, actually. So I'm just going to wait. But you could talk about it. We can talk about it on the show.
When did the trailer drop?
Like last month, man.
Oh, crap.
He missed that? Okay. Well, it's out. Stranger Things 2, Stranger Things 3 has been greenlit.
What? Really? Already?
Before Stranger Things. Well, how to get all the filming in they can while those kids are still looking like kids.
Young. Yeah, that's true. That's very true.
That makes a lot of sense.
Now, what do you think about that kind of genre of horror where, because if you look at a lot of what Stephen King does, it's very much usually nasty supernatural horror hides among small towns. Just because from where he grew up, the community doesn't want what they do on the outside, want to be on the outside. They want to keep everything in house and stuff like that. Or do you think that what makes that scary is we can, to some extent, identify with things creeping in the shadows, like in everyday life?
Well, yeah, I think, Stephen King, he grew up in small town Maine.
Yeah.
So that makes a lot of sense that would come from his personal life. But yeah, I think it's like very relatable. Whether it's, a small suburb, he's written stories like that, where, a lot of stories where it's basically just people living in the suburbs, and that's how most people live, right? So.
Well, I think, speaking of Stephen King and small town horror, have you guys seen the new trailer for It?
Yeah, that's creepy. Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, It, for its time back in the day, was pretty intense, but to have prove on that creepy factor, especially with the clown. One of my friends is a police officer, and he sees some pretty nasty stuff every day, but he likes to come home and sit down on the couch with his girl and watch a horror movie or two because she gets freaked out by them. So he was thinking about getting some balloons and just floating them through the house and just randomly walking through periodically saying, you'll float too. You'll float too. And, she was going to kill him for doing that. But he's been randomly walking around the house with that catchphrase. And the other day when he came to train, he had a big bruise on his arm. I'm like, did you use the you float too line? He's like, yeah, she might attack me.
I mean, I still use that line from the original movie, We all float down here.
Right? Creepy. Now, how do you establish that vibe in a game? Like, what do you, what kind of tricks and mechanics do you use to float something like that? When you're creating a game.
So yeah, I mean, that was definitely on my mind making Abnormal Things because the original game I based off of Abnormal is a game about body horror, and it has one main character who is experiencing this very internal horror. But, you know, Stranger Things is about, to me, it's about a small town coming together, sort of, or people in that small town who become aware of this terrible thing, right? So I feel like the town is sort of a character in that. So I added this whole step to the game where you, the history of the town, sort of, so that you can draw things from the history into where this monster came from or what's going on in the town. And into creating characters, you know, finding interesting ways to place characters together in that town. And it's always a small town, so everyone kind of knows each other. And then you kind of, you also make a bunch of characters at the beginning of the game, that all kind of know each other and care each other to a certain extent, care about each other. So every character has someone they care about, and those are the characters that are going to get threatened during the game and, you know, can get abducted or killed by whatever it is stalking the town. So I think just having that relationship to the town and is so that when something bad happens to them, it makes it a lot scarier, you know, because it's because you care about it. Yeah. I don't think anything's really scary unless you really care about whether something bad's going to happen.
Now, is that what Stephen King does best? He makes you care about what's going on so that the horror seems worse?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, he does create those. He has a lot of stories where he creates a big cast of characters, and you know a lot of them are going to be cannon fodder, but they're not just, you know, one-dimensional characters. He puts a lot into them before he kills them off. So
maybe that's why he goes back to the themes of childhood so often, because you kind of, most people have warm feelings about childhood, and sort of juxtapose, you know, getting that vibe and then juxtaposing it with, you know, horror of things from beyond the veil. It's you know, makes for a potent mix, and Stranger Things kind of does that too, because it's, you know, very nostalgia tinged with the D&D, and, you know, there's a million little nods to, you know, life back in the 80s. And I know you didn't see the trailer, so it doesn't give anything away. There's a scene of Halloween where the boys are all wearing Ghostbuster outfits.
Oh, nice. That makes sense.
Yeah. And just, I've got a pretty strong rule against sequels. I mean, I'll make an exception and check out the first few episodes of this. Stranger Things ended so well. I'm just not sure. I mean, just kind of the epilogue tag they did where, you know, the guy gets the phone from, gets the new camera. I thought camera and said phone. You can tell we're in 2017. and, you know, and you see the sheriff go out and put the waffles in the box in the woods, and it just kind of, you know, it seemed like it was a perfect way of kind of tying things up and sort of leaving it open-ended the way you like horror movies to do. But I don't know where you get 8 more episodes out of that, you know? I don't know. What do you guys think?
It all starts with waffles.
Right. Well, I'm like both excited and apprehensive, right? You know, it's like, I hope they do it well.
Yeah.
I'll be surprised and, you know, it'll be good, but who knows?
All right. We'll say, so Abnormal Things was based on Abnormal, which you mentioned was more of a body horror game, a storytelling game. So, not really using dice so much. This looks like, note cards.
Yeah, one dice.
1 4-sided die, 10 or so counters. And you really should familiarize yourself with the rules of Abnormal because it borrows from that heavily, which your introduction says. What kind of response have you been seeing at, you know, conventions and from playtest groups? What kind of thing?
People really like it. All the games I've run, people, you know, we creep each other out. I think that's the most important part. You know, the last game I played was at a game convention recently, and I was like literally creeped out. There was a thing where there was like a weird bug that like ate this old lady's finger and bit her finger off. And there's a scene where like we in a corner and her friend sees the finger slowly getting munched into its mouth. At night, I was like in bed hiding my fingers under my body so like nothing could eat them while I was trying to fall asleep. And stuff.
The interesting thing that we were talking about before we hit the button was the dynamic of the turns, because the turns alternate back and forth between the witnesses who are going through all of this and the horrors. And I think one of the cool sections that you have in the PDF is when you're on the witness turn, it says, act like nothing is wrong. Because, I mean, when you're watching those shows, you know, like, you know, you see somebody just walking down the hallway and they got like a candle or they're looking at their cell phone or something like that. And then you see kind of like a shadow walk behind them and they're oblivious to that. So that's kind of cool. But I mean, that's easy to do in a movie because it's scripted, you know. How has it been at the table where you don't have that script and people have to kind of work through that?
Well, yeah, I think that being a thing on the table, right? Like this is a thing you can do and should do sometimes. It's good to have there because it's easy once like the horror comes out for people to be like quickly sort of snowball into like, oh, we all have to band together and kill this thing. But you kind of want to like draw that out, you know? So. And I think sometimes the more realistic response for people is to be like, to act like nothing's wrong, like be in denial that this thing is happening, or try to carry on with your life as normal.
Everything and, is fine. Yeah.
Yeah, and then that makes it, you know, when it doesn't go away, you can't ignore it. You know, it makes it kind of scarier, I think. and that's from, I mean, that bit of that move or whatever you want to call it, is from Abnormal. I think that's one of the things I liked about it. Basically, the reason I picked Abnormal for the game or to base the game off of is because I thought Abnormal was one of the best games for doing horror that I had played for a long time. And then Abnormal was written by a friend of mine, Avery Alder. So I don't know, it just came to me that I was like, I think it would be really interesting to see this game with a larger cast of characters where everyone gets to play a character and make it more multiplayer and in a way that I think is usually fun for role-playing games, you know, for everyone to have their own character, right? But and use that for Stranger Things, and I think it works. Yeah. So,
do you think? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mike.
I was just going to ask if you had favorite horror games from other publishers that maybe you tried out in the past, or World of Darkness, or Call of Cthulhu, or that kind of thing.
I did play a lot of World of Darkness. I played, you know, werewolf and vampire. I actually did vampire LARP when I started college, and that was weird. Those are weird times.
Yeah, vampire LARPs could be awfully dramatic, couldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, my experience was like there were a lot of people there who were there for weird, like there's people there for like fetish reasons. There's people there for you know, they feel better about themselves that they can act scary, or I don't know, there's a lot of weird people there. And then there's like the small group of like grounded cool people that I would just role play with basically and try to avoid everyone else. And there's also like you get power gamers, people who are like, my vampire can take 6 moves before you can do anything because they have celerity or all that stuff.
Yeah, there was a guy, it was the storyteller of a World of Darkness LARP where I was going to college, and he was famous for Green Cane. you know, the grand progenitor of all vampires in the World of Darkness, into the game, things started to go away he didn't like. Mm-hmm. And his other GMs would actually just sigh and shake their heads and take him off to the side and say, like, Bob, what did we tell you about doing this last time? So,
no GM PCs.
Yeah, it was a thing. But yeah, I was trying to be diplomatic. But yeah, it's there's a great Coen Brothers style movie to be made sometime about you know, all the hijinks that happened in various vampire LARPs back in the day.
Oh, yeah, I could see that. Man, if the Coen Brothers made that movie, it'd probably be amazing.
Maybe a collaboration between Kevin Smith and the Coen Brothers. But
oh yeah.
Now you're just hurting my head.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to do that. So. All right, cool. So, So there's a sequel to Stranger Things. Have you considered doing a sequel to Abnormal Things?
Well, I'm still working on putting it out into the world. You know, I kind of want to see some, you know, someone write an actual review of it that's published somewhere or something like that before, you know, I'll feel satisfied. I mean, this right here is basically that in a way. So.
Well, I apologize. We didn't have a chance to play test it. Life gets kind of busy. But why don't we tell our listeners where they can find it in case someone wants to, you know, take a look at it, maybe play it with their group, or even post a review somewhere.
Right. So I have it hosted on my blog, which is Orion Canning on Blogspot. And then it's a Google Drive link from there. And I think if you search for Abnormal Things, it comes up on Google now as like you get a bunch of Stranger Things stuff and some other things, and then it's like the seventh link on there or something.
Yeah, I just searched for it right now. It looks like you have a thread on RPGNet that comes up.
Oh, cool! Yeah, yeah. I posted on Reddit, and I got really good responses on Reddit both times. I posted it once, and I posted it again when I did a big revision of it. And, you know, I got like 200 likes or whatever upvotes.
Oh, 242 right now.
Yeah, yeah. And that was like practically overnight, you know.
Yeah, that is rare because the RPG subreddit on Reddit is sometimes cool and friendly. And sometimes just the opposite of cool and friendly. So,
most of the times, everything else I post on Reddit usually gets, you know, very little notice. But so I was really surprised when that happened. That's one of the things that made me sort of, you know, feel confident and like, oh, I should try to like contact people like you guys to, you know, talk about the game.
Now, right now, you have it on your blog where people can go in and download the rules and check it out for free. Have you thought about a kicked up version with like a box set or something like that with actual cards, maps, stuff like that that people might be able to buy and kind of not increase the value of the game, but like increase the value of the experience so that nothing sells a product more than amazing art that evokes the setting. So like have you thought about stuff like that?
I have been kicking around this idea of maybe doing maybe kickstarting or crowdfunding a publishing run of a game, and I'd have to add some things to the game. So I'd add more examples of play. I'd probably add maybe like some like a different version of the game is an idea that I was kicking around my head of like maybe doing another style of horror or like basing something off of like a different type of horror show.
What were you thinking of?
Another reskinning of it. I have a bunch of different ideas. So I mean I could do like, you know, just straight up 80s horror as one idea that I've been thinking of, but I'm a really big fan of Nightmare on Elm Street. So I think what could be really cool with this game is dream-based horror sort of thing, where like because the horror gets to control all your senses in the game, which is sort of an interesting spin on like the whole GM player thing, I think, where and it makes it creepier because the horror is like has a little bit more control over you than is comfortable, I think, when they can say like feel this crawling on your skin or, you know, have all those sensory details makes it creepier. So the idea that if it was like a Nightmare on Elm Street sort of situation or some kind of dream monster, they could sort of GM this whole creepy dream scenario for you, this nightmare scenario.
Which would be kind of cool too, because you have in things like Nightmare on Elm Street, the thing that brings attention in the most is not so much Freddy, because everybody knows at some point Freddy's going to come in and he's going to do what he does. And once that happens, you know, somebody's going to die. The tension really comes in and how long can these people stay awake and what can they do to stay awake and combat that? Because, I mean, you can only fight your body so long.
That's true. Yeah, that's a really good point that that could be like the act like nothing is wrong could be changed to like try to stay awake or something like that.
You know, or like, even as you go through the game, you know, have some sort of a die mechanic, a card mechanic or something like that. You could almost make this into like a board game like Descent or something like that, where when you have the board of the map out, you know, you have the real world map and then you could have the dream map on the other side. But I mean, you could have a card or a dice based mechanic that at some point they just can't help it. They fall asleep, you know, and at that point the horror takes over. That's actually a pretty neat idea.
Yeah. So I mean, that's just one of the ideas I have kicking around, but I've been looking at some artists. There's this artist, J.M. Fenner, who does this sort of, I don't know, sketchy, it's sort of like unpolished looking, but very, very surreal art. If you look up his website, he's got some art of like people with glowing eyes walking through the woods. So I was considering him because his known and really interesting looking style that as a abnormal things artist. So I've been talking to him about maybe doing some pieces that I can use for doing a Kickstarter and then eventually put their art into the game and then use that to fund some more artists, you know, stuff like that. Yeah, it's originally I kind of just wanted to put it out for free because Abnormal Things was put out for free. But someone pointed out to me originally Abnormal was written for a game convention and it was commissioned and there was a printed version of it that was had nice cards and everything. So I was like, oh yeah, that makes sense. I could just for money.
And you know, if you did a sequel based around, because you said you were a fan of like 1980s horror and stuff, if mm-hmm. you did a sequel based on like Saturday the 14th or Monster Squad, I know Mike and I would definitely have to, you know, jump in on that.
Right. Yeah. I don't know if those would be Kickstarter goals or sequels, but yes.
I was actually joking because those are kind of comedy horror.
Oh, right.
That's one niche no one's tried in RPGs that I can think of. I mean, horror games are rare enough by themselves, but comedy horror, I don't think anyone's been brave enough to try that.
Oh, my God. If there was a Monster Squad rip, I'd be all over it.
Comedy horror, yeah. I'm not sure how to make that happen. Because I feel like that happens sometimes. Like, right, you're sitting around the table, you're joking around. So it just kind of naturally happens sometimes. But
well, like the Addams Family RPG, you know, where you're the monsters, but you're the monsters in the neighborhood suburb where nobody really minds.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, a lot of RPGs wind up being lighthearted just because the guys show up at your house with, you know, Mountain Dew and Cheetos. And, you know, they're just, you know, kind of cracking wise. But, yeah, I mean, it'd be cool to see something that was going for that kind of Tucker and Dale versus Evil, or, you know.
Oh, my God. Or what do you call it? Army of Darkness.
Army of Darkness, yeah.
Those are some favorites of mine, yeah.
I think we had Crystal Fraser on from Green Ronin one time talking about how comedy RPGs can be the hardest to do because you have to have game mechanics that lead to humor. And it's got to be funny, and it can be really hard to do. I don't know. It seems like maybe you're seeing more. I mean, like the actual funny gaming seems to be happening in card games with Exploding Kittens and a few others I can think of.
Cards Against Humanity.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can force humor, like force people to come up with a joke, right? But you can. Yeah. You can create a funny setup. I think that is, you know, like a good sitcom setup or whatever has lots of. For humor.
I would agree. I wonder, maybe just the natures of RPGs might lend themselves more to setting up a horror situation than a humor situation. I mean, because everyone I know has played Tune, but they played Tune like once or twice and moved on to something else. But people play Call of Cthulhu or, you know, Vampire Werewolf for years. Of course, Vampire and Werewolf, I don't know in your experience, Orion, but in mine, they always seemed like they started off as exploring horror themes and they kind of moved into supernatural superheroes within the
Yeah, totally. Sessions. Yeah, that was totally my experience with it. It kind of got close to scratching a certain itch, but never quite made it there, I think.
Yeah, I would definitely agree.
Another game I've played a lot that I really like in terms of horror RPGs is Monster Hearts.
Tell me about that one. I've heard of that, but I haven't really ever dove into it.
Oh, so, if you've watched the WB, you've got the idea.
Yeah. So Monster Hearts is actually also written by the same person who wrote Abnormal, Avery Elder. And it's an Apocalypse World system game. It was originally sort of the genesis of the game. It was going to be a joke game to make a game based on Twilight. I think when they did that, people really liked it. I feel like now the game, to me, it's mostly feels like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the show, the game. But it's definitely, you know, inspired by like CW shows or WB, like all these supernatural teen shows. And it has like one of the main moves in the game is turn someone on. So you're supposed to be like, it's about like the messy relationships of teenage monsters, like, you know, and sleeping with each other and sometimes murdering each other, maybe.
I don't know, around my game table, I do not want to use the move turn someone on. That's not going to happen.
I think that's like one of the main, like when people don't want to play that game, I think it's usually why. But I don't know if you played Apocalypse World. Have you played that?
I would really like to. I haven't had a chance to. We've had a few guys on to talk about, you know, games they had that were related to that. But no, that's one I haven't had a chance to play it myself.
We played my group. We played Apocalypse World, Dungeon World, and then after. A fine interview with the folks from the BAMF podcast. I convinced my group to play Worlds in Peril a couple of times, so that was kind of fun. They're all dying to play Masks, though, and I'm just like, I don't know. I like Young Justice well enough, but I don't know if I want to play in my, you know, relive my teen years.
I've played Masks. I like Masks. It's got a cool thing where you slip together these two cards, and one is like sort of your personality type, and one's the power type, and that kind of like creates your superhero. It's a cool way of making a character.
The mechanic where you're seeking the approval of your, you know, of your adult, you know, or your role model or stuff like that, that was like, oh no, I feel 14 all over again.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think there's definitely something there that they were trying to do. Right.
Now, do you actually just go for like I know for Abnormal Things you said that a lot of Stephen King, a lot of Stranger Things, but with horror creeping into so many different genres, stuff like Event Horizon or
Yeah,
certain like other things like medieval horror, or even like Mike was talking, supernatural horror in comics, like you know, Dark Justice League, or you know, like Agents of Shade or stuff like that. Do you get into stuff like that?
I mean, I love stuff like that. You can't. Maybe you could get away with doing something like that with Abnormal Things. Like, the idea is a small town, but I've played games where we've kind of played with that. So you could maybe do like a small town in the Old West, or a small town that's like a colony ship in space or something like that. I think that's all possible, but I don't know if I'd say Abnormal Things is the game for Event Horizon or something, but maybe.
What about in like an apartment building? You see like, you know, some of those, or like Attack the Block. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah. Yeah. Like one of the games I've played, we were doing a thing like that. So yeah, we had the idea of like, I think for it to work well in Abnormal Things, it needs to be like somehow that place is a community, or like it's somehow a self-enclosed one where there was an old apartment building that someone had built a freeway that cut it off from the rest of the city that had like no underpass. So this like tenement building sort of became this like, you know, run down ghetto sort of building that where it was just cut off from the rest of the city. That was cool. And then sort of like some of the, like the convenience store nearby was like the only place to go for food around and stuff like that. So yeah, you can play with the setting and do some interesting stuff.
Oh. Well, cool, guys. I have to skate to a meeting here in about 2 minutes. Do we want to wrap things up?
Absolutely. Orion, what else can you tell us about the game real quick?
Let's see.
Can you give us that link? That link to where they can go get it again?
Yeah. It's like I said, it's my blogspot.
So that's oriancanning.blogspot.com, and it's the very first thing they see when they go to your blog is it's right there, and that's Canning with two N's for anyone with trouble spelling Canning. It's
Orion, like the constellation, and then CANNING, like canning a canning factory or something like that.
Cool. Well, I really appreciate your time, and if you're going to kickstart it or do a sequel, hit us up, and we'll definitely have you back on and talk about it some more.
Okay, yeah, thanks. I'm looking into that, so maybe that'll happen. Thanks for having me on your show. Appreciate it.
Anytime. And listeners, thanks for tuning into the BANF podcast, and we'll catch you next time.